Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Daniel LaRue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. I wanted to do an NCAA tournament preview and got on the best guy I know for it, which is Dan Hanner. He writes for Real GM and Sports Illustrated. He's very knowledgeable about college basketball, so he and I talk about the tournament from the beginning to the end, teams like Kentucky and Wisconsin, Arizona, everybody in between, to the bottom, the upset surprises early on. It's a great conversation, runs about half an hour. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks so much for coming on.
Pleasure to join you.
So I think the best place to start is you've obviously been going at this for a lot longer than most people. I like to think about the teams that, from your experience, are getting maybe a little bit too much or a little too little love in terms of the general conversation.
In terms of who's getting too much love and too little love? I mean, I'm surprised. You know, I guess I'm really torn on Virginia because, it's part of it is just the visual image I have in my mind. Justin Anderson with his two fingers taped there in the ACC tournament, where he just did not look like the same player to me. I've seen so many people pick Virginia for the Final Four, and I totally get it. If Virginia had everybody healthy, you know, backline defense, they're really hard to score against. They've been having, you know, their second fabulous season in a row. Well, 100% healthy like that. I'm just surprised at how many people have sort of chosen them to go deep in brackets. I mean, you know, other teams that I think people are picking too much. I mean, this is kind of a hard tournament to make that statement in because, as I was saying the other day, there are not a lot of really good mid-majors that made the field this year. You know, Murray State got upset. Teams like Georgia State was going to be one of my upset picks for the longest time, and then Ryan Harrow, the Kentucky transfer, who's been one of their three players, he gets injured just in the final, just before the conference tournament. And so a lot of the mid-majors, you know, normally you look and you think, here are the two just are locks to win because they've had such fabulous seasons. But those teams really aren't there this year, and so favorite teams move. And because a lot of the favorites, it's sort of hard to say who is, you know, particularly overrated. I mean, I do think, you know, we may see more upsets in the middle rounds of this tournament because so many of the favorite teams advance. But there aren't a ton of teams that I think are super overrated. I think the committee obviously made some mistakes on some teams. I mean, but it's funny. I think Georgetown was a little overseeded as a four seed, but the committee didn't do them any favors by shipping out to Portland to play Eastern Washington and Portland, where Utah is also going to be in the same bracket. So basically, everybody in the stadium is going to be cheering against the Hoyas. You know, they probably should have been a five or maybe even a six would probably have been more appropriate. But given that they didn't get a particularly favorable draw, it's not like they got a big prize for being overseeded. And I think, I guess maybe in our auditory, given, you know, UCLA being in the field, certainly a bit of a shocker, but this is actually what I've seen the committee do. I mean, usually you look and there's this what it looks like, the region of death, where nobody is, you know, there's so many brutally good teams there. But the committee just did a really fabulous job of putting good teams in each section, and I think, you know, people have sort of identified what those good teams are.
Yeah, I think that what's so exciting about this tournament is that there may be less first-round upsets, but to me, what I've been seeing is the second and third round, I think, could be really dynamic this year. And to me, the two biggest, most surprising kind of seeding and all of that matchups for me were Michigan State as a 7, and I said it as soon as the bracket was announced. I don't know, it's just a gut feeling. You've watched a lot more college than I have, but I feel like Wichita State has a really good chance against Kansas, and there's so much kind of personal and all of that history in that game that I'm legitimately excited for the possibility.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, the other game, obviously that Michigan State-Virginia rematch from, you know, their recent tournament history would be fantastic. It's funny because Michigan State is one of those teams that is actually one of the least talented Spartans teams that Tom Izzo has said. I think I ran the numbers early in the season, and they have fewer top 100 recruits than they've had in a decade. You know, if you just sort of look on paper, this isn't a dominant Michigan State roster, and yet Tom Izzo has still won a ton of games this year in the Big Ten, and they do have top 25 margin of victory numbers. They've really, really been playing, you know, maximizing the talent they have, and I think they will give Virginia a very good game. Wichita State versus Kansas, to me, I'm really not even sure at this point if Wichita State would be, you know, an underdog, and if they are, you know, maybe 1 or 2 points in Vegas. I mean, that seems like a fabulous matchup. And the other second-round matchup that really looks intriguing to me would be North Carolina taking on Arkansas. Because, you know, since Mike Anderson went to Arkansas, he's had an up-tempo system. And the idea of USC and Arkansas, who both want to run, you know, playing in the same game, that could be one of the most entertaining games of the entire tournament if North Carolina and Arkansas advance.
And going from one of the most entertaining to one of the least, this is obviously looking a long, long way in. But you talked about it in your piece for Real GM. But I feel like my instinct, having been around, followed those teams a little bit, I feel like a Kentucky Wisconsin game or a Kentucky Arizona game in the Final Four would be distinctly not fun.
Well, it'll certainly be dramatic. I mean, I had a little discussion on Twitter this with. So I'm definitely somebody who agrees with shorting the shot clock to 30 seconds and that a faster-paced game would be good. But one of the things that I think, you know, people underestimate about watching Wisconsin and how they're entertaining to watch is that Wisconsin doesn't commit a lot of fouls. There aren't a lot of whistles in their game, and there aren't a lot of turnovers either. What there is a lot of up-and-down basketball with players making shots. And I think, you know, we sit there and we say, oh, well, there's not enough possessions in their games. That's too boring or whatever. You know, the idea of Wisconsin and Kentucky just going up and down the court and athletic players making plays, it's not necessarily, it might not have the most possessions. The score might only be, you know, in the low 60s. But, I mean, you know, Frank Kaminsky is as fun a player to watch as there is in college basketball. There was a great thing by CBS Sports today, you know, looking at shot charts and stuff like that, and how he can score so above average from so many different areas on the floor. I mean, I really could watch that kid all the time.
I think the other part of the reason for me is something, having attended 3 Final Fours in person and having watched it for a lot longer than that, is that you also, now that they're playing those games in football stadiums, the first games of the Final Four for all these teams are always rough in at least the first half because it's the guys adjusting to the weird arenas. I feel like what's going to happen with that is Kentucky's defense is going to cause Wisconsin a lot of problems, and it'll be a weird game. But at the same time, you know, like we can move on to Kentucky as well, that I think they're really, really good. I don't think they're invulnerable, but they got really lucky that, particularly in their bracket, in their region, I don't know who really has a shot at them.
Absolutely. If you look in their region, I don't think there's anybody I don't see anybody there who could be a huge threat to them. And I should also say, as you were saying, for, you know, Arizona in the Final Four, which is I was talking about Wisconsin's possibility, but it's certainly a 50-50 shot at least that it's Arizona who would be playing Kentucky there. And that would be the game that I think would be really interesting because of Arizona's length. And we've seen games that they've played this year where if it was Arizona and Kentucky in one of those huge football stadiums, you know, you could be talking about a real brick fest for a long time, as nobody can get any inside baskets, nobody can get any clean looks, which is why Arizona could, you know, definitely be competitive in that game as well. But you're 100% right on Kentucky being, having an easy draw. And I think you started to say there, you know, is Kentucky invulnerable? Can they not be beat? One of the things is we tend to pick apart these players so much for so long, and some of them, and I think with the way Kentucky has had so much talent this year, you know, we really haven't had a chance to note or figure out what the flaws of these different players are. I mean, I certainly don't think, you know, all their players are perfect, but, when they're only playing 25 minutes a game, when they're only playing in a circumstances where they're guarded one-on-one, they've never been double-teamed, you know, you really are, you know, certainly a lot of the guards, some of the forwards have been double-teamed, but we haven't picked their game apart the way we tend to pick apart some of the other, you know, super elite athletes. And so, you know, in a competitive environment, we don't necessarily know what their flaws are. Right now, they look nearly perfect, but if they're playing Arizona and it's 42-42 with 3 minutes to go in the game, it could be interesting.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I also think that Kentucky's biggest weakness is that I feel like their offense can come and go. And so there aren't that many teams that fit this bill this year. But to me, what their biggest weakness would be against a team that can just get theirs regardless of what the other team's doing. You know, the guys who you can think of it as just a shooter or whoever, but the guys who can just, they're just shot makers or whatever like that. And I also think that teams without big men probably are going to be better against them, because when you have Towns and Colley Stein, I just think you're not going to score on the interior anyway.
No, but it's, you know, it's funny. I mean, I would much rather have had Duke or maybe an Iowa State or even some team like that be able to play them somewhat earlier in the tournament than, you know, Notre Dame, who I think a lot of people are picking for the Midwest final, because Notre Dame does not have a lot of size in the middle. And I just feel like maybe Notre Dame will be able to freeze against Kentucky, but Kentucky is going to just be able to destroy Notre Dame in the paint, and they're going to, you know, and as you said, Kentucky has droughts, but one of the things this year is they have such incredible offensive rebounders that even when Kentucky misses shots, a lot of times the missed shot for Kentucky is the best offense because yep. they just, big guys goes up and gets it.
Yeah, and they have so much depth that they don't have to deal with foul trouble as much. You know, if Cauley Stein or Towns gets in trouble, then you just throw in someone else, and that's a luxury that other teams don't have, and whether they're going platoon or they're not going platoon, they just have so much flexibility.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I've said the reason I'm actually really confident in Kentucky right now is because they've, you know, tightened the rotation down to 8 guys. Marcus Lee really not playing meaningfully minutes at this point of the season. But, you know, Marcus Lee is not a scrub. I mean, even last year in the NCAA tournament, there were a couple times when he had to come in games because of foul trouble and the injury situation to Will Cauley-Stein, and he played well. And so, you know, right now Kentucky has 3 bigs who rotate, you know, pretty well. But if Marcus Lee has to come in as the fourth, you know, it's not a huge drop-off in terms of, you know, rebounding and defense and things like that. So, It's they have quality depth, and they also have players who really, I mean, it's the knowing their roles. I mean, I think everybody on that team, you know, sort of knows what they can and can't do, and, you know, they're playing to their strengths right now.
Yeah, and so you and I talked about before we recorded this that one of the things with Kentucky is, since we're not really questioning that they're going to make it in a while, is how to make it interesting in a way with one of their games. And something that you thought of, which I think would be fun, is with whatever amount of group of people you have, to pick a certain group of people and just see who scores more points. So you and I talked about doing that as a game. Without your knowledge, I flipped a coin just now. Do you want heads or tails?
I'll take heads.
Okay, so it was tails, so I'll start. So we're going to do 2 people. I thought about this, and considering they do an 8-man rotation, you could run it with 3 people as well if you wanted, or 4 if you really wanted to. That's the nice thing about an 8/9 rotation. So if I have first pick, in terms of all we're counting as points scored, I'm going to go with Aaron Harrison.
Yeah, it's pretty logical. I should have probably done something complicated with blocks and steals and assists, but I'm going to be too lazy when the tournament's going on. But yeah, just to set the stage again, so we're going to do a fantasy draft of the 8 guys from Kentucky, and the whole point here is, When we're watching, you know, presumably Manhattan, but Manhattan or Hampton get hammered in the first round, and we're watching that Kentucky game, at least make it interesting to have something to choose for, which is these guys, you know, get points for Kentucky. So, yeah, logical first pick. I'll take Devin Booker as the logical second pick. You know, both guys, you know, tremendous shooters, and I think both guys are likely to see their roles increase in the tournament for the simple reason that it's happened late in the year that Kentucky has gone with 3 guard lineups more often, and the whole purpose is to have more shooters spread the floor more against zone defenses or people that are packing it in the paint. And so Aaron Harrison and Devin Booker are the logical 2 guys to score a lot of points.
And since I get to go third, I'm happy because I get to take the guy that I would take number 1 in the draft, and you don't have to touch that if you don't want to, Karl-Anthony Towns.
Right, so I'm glad you took the part that I will is I'm with foul trouble issue that you said. You know, it's not that I don't think Karl-Anthony Towns can stay in games and play without fouling, but John Calipari has basically said to him, go all out. Don't worry about whether you're in foul trouble or not. And if there's been any guy on Kentucky who tends to get in foul trouble and end up sitting for most of the game because he really can't play, it would be Towns, but that doesn't necessarily mean that's necessarily a skill that'll translate to the NBA. I think it just has to do with the way he's being used right now. But since you said you like him for the top of the draft right now, why don't you give me a little your thoughts on why that is?
Okay, so to me, the most important thing that a center can do, ideally a big man, but a center, is protect the rim. And so the reason I don't like Jahlil Okafor, in that sense, he's still obviously a great player, fabulous player, is that you have to take a big leap of faith if you're going to take a big man who can't do that, and I definitely think that Karl Towns can. And I think that the weaknesses in his game, though I don't think there are many, can be easily corrected, and I feel like the right coach can get a lot out of him at the professional level.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can totally buy that. I mean, I have soured on Okafor a little bit lately. Although, I mean, you know, the thing I think we need to consider with Okafor is, his footwork, for a player of his age, I mean, you can work as you grow older and you get to the NBA and stuff like that on footwork and things like that, but I just don't remember an 18-year-old who's so mobile. I mean, Kaminsky is having great footwork and great mobility, but my main concern with Anthony Towns is I don't think he has necessarily been, as I said before, face the challenge in like some of these other players, because teams have had to play him one-on-one a lot more in the paint than you would necessarily expect, because Kentucky shooters can make shots, and I just feel like his game hasn't been exposed as much what his weaknesses and what his flaws are. But the truth is, I think that defensive point is a really good one. And if you're looking at it, you know, in a draft with a lot of great centers, you know, might as well go to my next pick, which would So I got to make the choice between Will Cauley-Stein and Andrew Harrison, who are fairly similar in points. I'm going to go with Will Cauley-Stein over Harrison, and I'll probably explain the logic against Andrew Harrison if you don't pick him in a minute, although that would be pretty logical. I think Cauley-Stein is going to be on the floor a ton for Kentucky in this tournament because he really is that unbelievable defender. I mean, I've never seen someone who... He's a center. I mean, he can defend centers, but he can also defend small forwards, move his feet. I really thought his draft stock was going to fall this year going back. I thought his minutes would be limited. I just don't really think it should. I mean, he has done everything and more and continued to get better. And, you know, he may never be the dynamic offensive player that Karl Anthony Towns will be, but there are a lot of teams that could use, you know, a center with the mobility, the shot blocking, the overall defensive ability of Will Cauley-Stein.
Yeah, to me, what Willie Cauley-Stein is he's what DeAndre Jordan's draft stock should have been. DeAndre Jordan was a really talented guy, and DeAndre was a freak physically in a way that Cauley-Stein isn't, but Cauley-Stein is a more cerebral player in a way that DeAndre wasn't at the time. But what he is he's a guy who does the most important thing for a center to do in today's NBA, and he does that really well. I've had Cauley-Stein in the top 10 of my draft board since he was a freshman, and there's a reason for that. I think that he is going to really work at the next level, and the best argument for him in some ways is what Rudy Gobert has done for Utah, is that he's just a really good defensive player, and you can get scoring for everywhere else on the floor. And he can do it in transition. The reason I would have taken Stein, and I'm going to take Andrew Harrison, but why I would have taken Stein, I would have been happy with him in the next round, is the first half of their first two games, I feel like he's going to annihilate because he'll be juiced up and he'll get a lot of points in transition. And that's going to be huge. I mean, because they're, until they sit him because they're up by 30, I think that he was going to get that opportunity. And so now I have both Harrison twins, which I'm not super happy about.
So are you going to take Andrew Harrison, or are you going to move down and surprise us by taking
No,
else?
I'm taking Andrew. I have to. And that'll be kind of exciting to have both of them.
Well, at least if you're going by visualization on the screen, you won't have to try and look for their number to figure out who it is. But all right. So then the case for me, boy, you know what? This is a really tough one. I'm certainly, the next three choices are pretty clearly Trey Lyles, Dakari Johnson, and Tyler Ulis. And I do feel good about Trey Lyles. I do like him a lot. But I think I'm going to just, you know, jump to the gun in case you switch off on this. And I'm going to take Ulis. Because I really think in this NCAA, I mean, we've seen his minutes start to tick up a little bit here at the end. I think Ulis is going to be a big factor in close tournament games late in the tournament. I just think he's the point guard who can penetrate. He's the point guard who defends better. And I think even though he's sitting there at 5.6, he's not a super aggressive offensive player. I just think he's going to play a big role late in the tournament.
I would have taken Ulis over Lyles and Johnson. So that was a good pick that you did that. I'll take Lyles. And so I'm assuming you're going to take Dakari.
Yeah, so I'll take Dakari Johnson, who I don't think we dislike much as it was last year. I think Dakari Johnson is the super talented center who just happens to be behind some super talented players on the Kentucky Wildcats.
So I want to move on from them to a team that you have in your Final Four. I believe you might even have them in your title game. You do, of Iowa State. They're a really well-coached team, and they're a really good team. But a point that you made in that I think is really important to understand about Iowa State is that the differences between last year and this year make them a more likely long-going tournament team.
Yeah, I mean, they really just have a more versatile lineup. I mean, last year they were a fun team because they had... You know, everybody could shoot, and they had some guys like Dustin Hogue, who's only 6'6", but he's an incredible rebounder. And so they really, you know, they made the most of their talent. They played great. But, you know, if Iowa State was going to face a team that had a lot of big forwards, a lot of big guys, they didn't really have, you know, somebody to match up. I mean, Georgie Niang is phenomenal, but, you know, you really want him available for his offense. You don't want him to be banging down in the post. And so, you know, getting Jameel McKay this year, who was going to go to Marquette, I believe, and ended up transferring to Iowa State, he... You know, he's just been a big, big addition, and his playing time and his production has only increased as the season wore on. We got a little info from the team early in the year that we thought he was going to play a lot, and then, you know, early in the year he really didn't, but he's come on, and And the other, Abdul Nader as well, is another guy who hasn't necessarily played a ton of minutes, but he's another sort of big body that they, you know, sort of versatile that they can throw in there in various circumstances. And so this is just, much like Oklahoma, you know, they're a team that's going to depend on their starters and their main primary guys for the scoring and stuff like that, but they just have a little bit more versatility this year, I feel like, if they get into certain, you know, matchup situations.
And something else that goes in their favor is that their number one seed, Duke, has tough matchups every round after the first round. I feel like San Diego State, while not certainly the favorites in that, has a reasonable chance, and every single round, Duke will face a team that, as long as they make it, that will be a challenge for them.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, San Diego State is not a fun team to play. I mean, they're just, their length at every position, they're a great defensive team, and they've made runs in the tournament in recent years. A lot of those players are still back. I think Xavier Sainz is in the NBA now, but, you know, just about everybody else is back on that squad. And so I agree. I mean, in some senses, as I wrote about, like the South region, I think there are a ton of defensible picks across the board there of really good teams. We talked about Iowa a little bit in the intro there, that they're a hotter team than people necessarily expected. If you actually, I'm going to micro bracket instead of the macro, the one spot that I think is the hardest to pick, as we said earlier, is the Virginia, Michigan State, Oklahoma, Providence section, where even Providence, Providence is a team, I'm a little surprised at how much Dunn's stock has risen at point guard there for Providence, but with LaDante Hinton and Dunn, they, two guys who I think is undersized, I don't know, but who have, legitimate star NBA level talent to them, to be maybe the fourth choice to come out of that little section of the bracket, I think it's going to be a really, really interesting section to see who ultimately advances in that half of the East.
Do you happen to know what the other two teams are in the Virginia-Michigan State game? Because I was trying to think about how the fan atmosphere in that will be.
Oh, yeah, that's so it's Georgia and Belmont. And, you know, Georgia's one of those teams that I really feel like, it's such an odd feeling. I don't have a really good feel for them. The power numbers have been better than expected. They obviously played pretty well against Kentucky late in the year, but that Nemanja Durasitz, he had the game of his life against Kentucky there. And I just, Michigan State's been playing so well that I don't think Georgia will have much of an effect. And Belmont is a really well-coached team. I'm not sure. Yeah, so it's in Charlotte. And so it's going to be Virginia fans for the most part in Charlotte. I wouldn't think Michigan State's, Michigan State will have some fan base.
Well, the one thing I'll add is, so that game would be a second round game. So that means that the other one will be Duke, presumably against either San Diego State or St. John's. And as somebody who's been there for the second round a lot, it's going to be really fun. It's going to be really fun because I don't know how Duke fans feel about Virginia, because a lot of times you would think that conferences would root for one another, but from my experience, it depends on the personal feelings between the fans. Like when UCLA and Washington were in the same place, the Washington fans rooted against UCLA, but the UCLA fans rooted for Washington because they hated us a lot more than we hated them. So that will be a factor, but it's in Charlotte, so I think Virginia will have a lot of people. Michigan State usually travels pretty well, but as we always say, that's on the margins. You know, that's very rare unless you get into those circumstances where it's the only exception to that is a true Cinderella gets a home court advantage for the last 5 minutes because everybody roots for them.
Trust me, I've been to plenty of Duke NCAA tournament games. The entire stadium turns against Duke. Well, it was a pretty memorable one in D.C. a few years ago. I feel like it was against Beaumont or something like that. But, that's a good point. And I do worry with Michigan State fans, not that they're not, I mean, Michigan State fans are some of the best fans in the country, but in a year where they're a 7 seed, where they didn't necessarily have as high expectations, I'm not sure this is the year that they will travel as well as usual. But how Duke fans feel about Virginia, it's not, Duke fans aren't necessarily going to cheer for North Carolina, but they might feel slightly different about Virginia. That's a good question.
Yeah, it'll be fun to see. So are there any other things in the bracket that you think are really interesting or compelling? One thing that you mentioned is that Valparaiso hasn't played a single NCAA tournament team, which I thought was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what way that cuts, right? I mean, on the one hand, they haven't been challenged to some degree, but on the other hand, and especially for a lot of these, I mean, I think that's what we love so much about it. These teams have made the tournament. They're all on winning streaks. They've all played well. Those kids on Valparaiso, they don't have any reason to think they won't win that game. They believe. They've been successful. So it'll be interesting. I think, you know, probably thinking about your UCLA squad, as we started to say at the beginning, and who got into the tournament at the last minute. So the question you asked me before we got on the podcast was, how should you feel about it, your team getting in or getting overseeded in some ways? And I say this, like, your litmus test for being a somewhat rational fan is that you can point to instances where your team has been overranked, overseeded, got lucky to get where they ended up. If you feel every single year your team has been jobbed for the committee for the last 10 years, then there's probably a good chance you're not looking at things rationally. But UCLA, I just, you know, they didn't have the quality wins. I felt the same way about Texas not having quality wins. With Texas, it's like, you know, people say, oh, they were 2-12 teams or some. And the thing I said is they were 2-4 against quality teams in the Big 12 at home. I don't care if they couldn't win on the road against quality teams, but, you know, you got to be better than 2-4 at home in order to earn your way in. And UCLA just didn't have very many of those quality wins, period. And so I'd never like to see teams like that get in because, you know, at a certain point, the regular season has to be about winning. It can't just be about looking good, you know, like, well, we looked good against Arizona. That was why we got in. That wins and losses should have some bearing. But having said that, both Texas and UCLA, teams that have the talent to advance. UCLA, it just depends, you know, their five starters, how well they shoot. It's going to depend a little bit on Tony Parker, how well he plays defensively against a pretty good front line for SMU. I've just had mixed feelings about Parker this season. I expected him probably to do a little bit more. The guards have been inconsistent with their shooting at times, but he really hasn't quite developed as much as I would have expected. But you know, you got Kevin Looney, who's probably going to be a high NBA pick. It's it's good to be in because you never know. Even when it's not your best year, if you're in, you got a chance.
Yeah, I think that's definitely fair. One question that I wanted to let you out on is: do you think there's a reasonable chance? I don't think there is this year, but you might, of 16 or 15 winning a game.
Yeah, no, I really don't. I mean, this is just not a year where enough of the strong mid-majors won that anybody, you know, seeded down that low is just very good. I mean, I was looking at the 14s too. You know, there are years where you feel relatively strongly. I might, if Georgia State didn't have that injury, they're 14, I might have felt decent about Georgia State. But, you know, if a 14 or a 15 wins this year, it will truly be shocking. It won't be one of those years where we go, oh yeah, well, they were pretty good. We just, you know, they got seeded a little too low. It'll be a true shocker if one of those teams wins.
Do you have any idea why they didn't put Georgia State with Louisville? Because, Kev, that would have been an easy storyline.
Well, you know, I think they theoretically don't do this based on storylines. And, yeah, I mean, I'm actually a little disappointed that Irvine faces Louisville just because big guys they draw your attention in some ways. You know, Georgetown's Josh Smith, 350 pounds, used to play for UCLA. When he's on the court, you can't take your eyes off him. You know, you just want to see, what is this big guy going, you know, people are going to run into him. Is he going to push his way around? You know, like, you just want to see it happen. And UC Irvine has this 7'6" center who, I mean, I don't care who you're playing against, 7'6" looks big. And so you throw him the ball in the paint. You want to see, is he actually going to be able to move that lumbering body and get a basket? Is he going to be able defensively to stop people from scoring? You know, will he slowly move over and block that shot? You can't take your eyes off him. But I don't like UC Irvine against Louisville just because Louisville's got a lot of big bodies, and Tino is going to sort of know how to attack that. It's just unorganized. So I'm a little disappointed with that, but I think, you know, he'll still be fun to watch that guy in action.
Absolutely, and what I'm so excited about with this tournament, we've talked about a little bit, is that I think that the first 2 days will be all right, but I think the first weekend and then Thursday, Friday of the second weekend are going to be absolutely incredible.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, as much as we enjoy those upsets, all upsets do is make the later part of the tournament less entertaining, and if there are fewer upsets, it means good games later, which is exactly what we want.
Thanks so much for taking the time. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yep, thanks a lot.
Thanks again to Dan Hanner for taking the time to come on. You can read him at Real GM and Sports Illustrated. You can and should also follow him on Twitter at Dan Hanner, DanHanner. Especially these coming weeks, he's a great guy to follow. And also for me, I love talking to him at the beginning of the season so he can tell me what to expect. And this should be a great tournament. I'm hoping to do a podcast either over the weekend or early next week talking about the draft prospects, because while the tournament is important, the other reason that's important for NBA fans, which is mostly what this podcast does, is the draft guys. And most of those players should be making it to the second weekend, so I think that timing will work out pretty nicely. As always, I'm going to do lots of NBA content as well. You can send any comments to me on Twitter at Danny LaRoux, DannyLeroux, or to daniel.laroux@realgm.com. I read everything, I respond to as much as I can, and I do always appreciate it. So thank you so much for listening, take care, and make it a great day.